and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special guest. His name is Jasper Ford, and his new book is called, it's a new Thursday Next book, it's called The Woman Who Died a Lot, and he's here to talk about it. Hello.
Hello there.
Did I say your last name right? Is it just Ford?
Yeah, it's just pronounced just like the motor car. Ford.
You see the two F's right away. You want to change this pronunciation for some reason.
Yeah, I've had that. It's like a lifetime of, you know, my father, you know, when he gave me this name, he said, "There you go, Jasper, a lifetime of explaining the spelling of your name." Okay. Thank you, Dad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have such a great sense of humor, and I'm reading the scene with the nuns right now, and it's just so much.
Yeah. Well, you know, non-on-non violence is, you know, clearly sort of something I think that's been avoided for many, many years, and I just thought, well, you know, let's put it in there.
Right. It works. It's very effective right in the middle of the book. I mean, it's like, oh my goodness, these nuns are crazy. It's like, makes you never want to go to a convent. but this is book number 7 in this series?
Yeah, number 7. Wow. Yes, it is.
It's hard, and you were rejected 72 times, I think, 70 sometimes.
Yeah, but that was over 10 years. So clearly, you know, 7.2 rejections a year. I clearly wasn't working that hard at it. But I think what I was doing is I was writing a book, and I sent it out, and then I used to get, you know, whatever, 10 rejections. And then 2 years later, I'd have another book and send that out. And I think it wasn't particularly me being rejected. Well, I mean, obviously it was. I think what it really was my writing wasn't good enough yet. And I think, you know, if there are any authors listening to your, or people who want to be professional writers listening to your program, it's a bit of a long haul, and the average seems to be about 11 years and 7 books. And by the time I've spoken to a lot of authors, and that does seem to be about the right thing. It's two things, really. You have to learn the skill. You know, this is a skill that has to be learned like any other, like, you know, playing the trumpet or juggling or unicycling or whatever. But the other point about it is that you have to get, you have to show the commitment. And authors are these strange creatures who cannot stop writing. You know,
right.
We can't stop ourselves. It's like, you know, even if, you know, we start getting itchy if we haven't written for a couple of days. And there's two things, you know, you have to get down there, you have to do 10,000 hours, all that keyboard time, and you have to get good enough. And when you are, they go, aha, Ford, right, the air affair, you're in.
Now, were you learning stuff as you were being rejected? I mean, did they tell you exactly what was wrong with your manuscript, and did you learn as a result of that?
No, they don't actually say anything, because, of course, you know, if they were to say something like, you know what, Jasper, I think this book doesn't have enough bananas in it. And you go, aha. And then you'd rewrite the book, and you'd spend 6 months writing bananas into every scene, and then they'd look at it, and they go, actually, you know, we're not sure about these bananas. No, they don't, because you could go in and, you know, and change it. They just say no. And then you go, aha. And then you look at it, and you rewrite it, and you're constantly rewriting, and you're thinking, this doesn't work. And then rewrite it again. And then you put it aside for 2 years, and you come back to it, and you go, oh, yeah, this doesn't work. And it's that sort of gradual sort of learning, you know, over the years that makes you a possible, you know, potential for publication.
Wow. Mm. You don't seem that frustrated by all those rejections. It seems like you...
No, not really, because you know, as I said, it was me learning my trade. And until you get good enough to be published, you know, you've just got to say, you know, self-criticism is the most important thing you have to have as an author. Or in fact, if you're trying to teach yourself in any sort of, you know, skill at all. And it's, yeah, I just said, okay, I'm not good enough yet. It's as simple as that. I've just got to keep at it. And I did. And, you know, and finally I got there.
That's wonderful. I mean, what a major, you know, keep trying kind of thing. And you know,
it does work. And I mean, I was very fortunate in that I had a, you know, a day job, and I was freelance, so I wasn't working all the time. So I actually had the days available to me to actually do this. Because the biggest problem of anyone trying to be a writer is finding the time. You know, it's hard. It's hard. There's lots of things going on.
Now, from what I hear, you changed the titles of Book 7 and Book 8. The Book 8's title was actually going to be Book 7's title.
Mm, yeah.
What's up with that? I'm curious.
Well, I've been... I had this notion for a while called about the dark reading matter. Now, what this is, inside the book world, in which a lot of these books are set, you know, the book world is a real place in which the characters all sort of run around and interact with one another. But I have this idea that there is a darker side of the book world, which is sort of forgotten books, lost books, erased memories, poems that poets never wrote down. And all that kind of stuff exists in this sort of strange, you know, ethereal world that you can't reach, you can't ever get into. So Thursday has been attempting to find a way into the dark reading matter. For a number of books now, because my Ela series sort of runs on. And I thought she was going to get into the dark reading matter in this one, but I just got sort of, I was sidetracked by the fun of having a deal with her teenage children. So I thought, right, we'll have a find a way into the dark reading matter in book 8.
I have to ask you, would you want to know what your future was?
Yeah, this is referring to Friday and getting the destiny becoming destiny aware.
That becomes a big part of the book without you realizing it.
It does, doesn't it? I think it's interesting. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, in amongst all the silly absurdness, there are some interesting thoughts. And with Friday, Thursday's son, it's the notion of finding a function for himself, you know, what he does with his life. And whether, you know, you can actually find that whilst knowing that your life is not going to amount to very much, and changing it. So I think there's all sorts of interesting ideas sort of sloshing around between the covers.
I think of myself, and I'm one of seven kids, I could have been named after a day of the week.
Yeah.
Very easily. I mean, that's the great thing about this book. It's got such a great sense of humor. I mean, and sometimes it's wild, and sometimes it's really funny. And, you know, and sometimes you're like, well, what is that? Is that really a word?
Yeah, I like making up words. Well, I think life is funny. I mean, it's, you know, it's very dark, but it's never without its humor. I mean, even in the, you know, in the worst times, there's always, you know, huge humor.
Well, don't we feel the best when we're laughing?
Yeah, well, I think so. Absolutely. And the so, and life and the humans are so absurd. I mean, we don't see it because we're on the inside looking out. But if you stop to think about all the bizarre things that we get up to and the endless sort of, you know, sort of self-denial and the constant sort of lies we tell one another and we get told by big companies and people in authority, and you think, what is going on? This is so bizarre. And I just like to counterpoint that in the books, really, just by sort of raising the curtain, perhaps.
And just reading The Woman Who Died a Lot, the more I read this book, the more interesting it gets. I mean, as I get more into it, I find myself being more fascinated and not being able to put it down. It's very different from anything I've ever read before.
Oh, good. Well, good. That sounds good.
When I first started reading it, I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know what all this means. I guess because I hadn't read the first book, so I'm a little... I'm starting out in the middle here, not being able to read seven books before I interviewed you. That's kind of difficult. I'm reading it, and when these characters are so wild, and I can only imagine what they're going to do with the film if they do a film version of this.
Who knows? I don't think there's so much. I pack so much into my books. I think there's about six subplots going on here. Everyone has their own individual story with their own little individual resolution in the books. And I just love packing it in. I love dense books with tons of stuff going on, but none of it is really extraneous. Everything kind of has a reason. Everything has a sort of link to whatever's going on in the rest of the book. So I love that kind of narrative.
Now, do you sit at your desk and like have all? Do you write down all the subplots so you remember them all? Is it difficult or do you automatically remember them?
No, I tend to write books very very fast. So it all kind of stays in my head. This took me about 6 months to write. And when you sit down day after day and then only take one day off at the weekend, you can kind of keep a lot of it actually in your head. And then when I'm writing, I go, this is what happens, this happens, I'll go back, redo that. And it's not too bad, actually, but I think it's a skill that one develops, you know, as any other. And being able to juggle with five subplots and, you know, 18 major characters... it's a skill, but I enjoy it. I think it's
great. It doesn't seem as bad as Game of Thrones. I don't know how many characters are in Game of Thrones, but there's got to be hundreds and hundreds
hundreds. Well, I get confused. When I read books where there are too many characters and they're all too similar, it's like reading Russian novels. You go, hang on, they've all got Russian names, which are hard to remember anyway, but then they have two names each, and you go, well,
yeah.
You know, it just confuses. confusing.
Or the name places. Some people get confused by the name places if they're not American names. You know, we all think of Chicago and Detroit, the cities in the United States, and they're easier to remember.
Yeah.
But you get into these other name places, and like, oh, I don't even know where that is, you know? In your mind, you can't see the place where it is in the area, but you know that you have to, and sometimes you have to look it up on a map to see exactly where it is.
Yeah, and that's that. Anything that stops the flow. If anyone has to, like, put down the book and then think about it or go back, it interrupts the flow. And there's a kind of, if you can keep the pace going, you know, pace is great because it really just absorbs people into books. But if there are things that you trip over in the book and you go, hang on, I didn't quite get that, it just breaks the pace and it's the illusion sort of vanishes. So I just like to keep the pace up.
You must be a very humorous guy to talk to. I mean, if I had lunch with you today, we definitely would laugh a lot.
Yeah, I mean, well, I like to have a bit of fun, really. The trick with being an author writing a sort of amusing book is in fact, you know, a single line in the book can make it look as though I'm very, very funny and I come up with it just like that. But actually, to, you know, let a little secret go, in fact, what I can do is I can condense being sort of mildly amusing for three pages into being funny for just one sentence. But that's what you can do when you've got a bit of time and you're an author.
And now you have a national on sale date for your books. I mean, that's big stuff. I mean, you're talking a major author you are now. I mean,
it's been good actually. I mean, this is my 12th tour now in the US, and it's really good. And I've got a terrific, you know, base of readers who come out and listen to me talk at the events. And buy my book every year, so it's great.
Well, what kind of reaction do you get to your books? I mean, what do people say about them? Do they say they're crazy? Do they say what do they say?
Pretty much, they just enjoy them on many different levels. They love the absurdist humor. They like the political satire. They like the characters. They love the detail. There's a lot of detail I throw into the books. Little sort of allusion, little references here and there to all sorts of things that reference either books or popular culture. And I think people just like it as a whole experience. It's like going into an antique shop, and there's like lots of little bits and bobs, and they're all very interesting, all very exciting, but somehow they relate to your childhood. You know, it's like the pedal car that you used to have when you were a kid, you know, and you just wander around the shop, and there's a little play going on there, and some characters talking about something weird. And it's just that sort of kind of immersive experience, I think, that not only in story, but in everything that, you know, makes us human.
Now, in The Woman who died a Lot, now, I love the fact you mentioned imaginary childhood friends. Did you have an imaginary childhood friend?
Well, I used to. Amphi Rock, his name was.
What was his name?
Amphi Rock. I have no idea why he was called Amphi Rock, but he was called Amphi Rock.
You never asked him?
I don't think so. You just don't think about that to ask imaginary friends. I think he probably left when I was about 3 or 4, maybe 4 or 5, but I did know he was imaginary. I mean, and all children do know, I think, that they're imaginary. So, you know, you secretly know it's imaginary.
I think of the little girls having tea parties with their imaginary dolls, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what they show in movies a lot.
But of course, imaginary friends, because they've been made up by people, they exist, you know, within the dark reading matter.
And do you think, I guess there's some psychological connection there, too. If you're inventing imaginary friends, maybe you don't have a lot of real friends.
I don't know, really. I mean, it was just like a special friend I seem to remember. And my children, I don't think my children had any, but my sister certainly did. I think she had several. I don't know what that's
So who is the woman who died a lot in this book?
The woman who died a lot is Thursday herself.
Right, that's what I was kind of suspecting.
And she's been, there are all sorts of themes that I've been exploring throughout the series. And for about the last three books, there's this notion that someone's, a big multinational corporation called Goliath, who have been a thorn in Thursday's side for many, many books now. They've been trying to send in synthetic Thursdays to try and trick her husband into giving them information that only she has. And these synthetic Thursdays are getting so good now, she can't actually tell when she is one. And I think that's just quite amusing. So she's, you know, sort of wandering around quite normally, and then she suddenly realizes that she's no longer herself, but been replaced by this synthetic Thursday.
And the synthetic Thursday, in one case, is actually younger and stronger than her.
Yeah, well, what they are is they're like sort of kind of budget humans. They're very smart, very strong, but they only last 24 hours, and they have no real metabolic functions, and anything you don't need in 24 hours, there's no elementary canal, for instance. You don't need to eat, you don't need to drink, you don't really need to do anything. So anything that is not required within a 24-hour lifespan has just been got rid of. So they're just a budget synthetic human. But they're very, very intelligent, and you can do anything, and you think you're this person, but of course you're only going to last 24 hours, and then you're back to your normal body again.
I wonder, see, and what's running through this book, the thing about her son, about how he knows his future. I just wonder how you're going to get around that and what's going to happen with that. So that's got me wanting to keep reading the book too, which is interesting. You know, how is he going to avoid his fate?
Yeah, well, that's it. How do we accept our fate? Because he's told that he's going to shoot dead Gavin Watkins in 4 days' time. And he doesn't even know who Gavin Watkins is. And the question is, you know, can he change his fate, or is he actually going to shoot Gavin Watkins? And it's that which is worrying him and his mother, Thursday, of course, throughout most of the book. You know, what is he going to do? Is he going to submit to his fate, or is he going to try and push destiny to change? Change destiny and get out of it.
And I like the fact you have chapter names to your book, in your books too, so we know what's coming up, sort of. We get an idea of what's come. We can see that Gavin's going to play a part later in the book, which is really interesting. So
yeah.
I like the fact that you can skip ahead a little bit to a book and see what's going to happen, and then you get to see how it leads up to that. I like doing that. Lately,
yeah.
I found that that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, well, most of my books take place during about a week. That they seem to start on Monday and then they end on sort of Friday or Saturday. And I thought, yeah, well, in the chapter headings, we just say exactly what happens in the days of the week. So each chapter heading is like Monday.
Oh, I see.
So we know what it was. And then, of course, because characters are named after names of the week, we have a chapter heading that says Thursday. So it's on Thursday, about Thursday. It's just a bit of fun.
It is a lot of fun. But now, it all started with The Air Affair. That was your first book in the series. How was that received, and how is it received in Wales today, your series?
It was actually received very well. I mean, I was incredibly lucky. I had no idea about publishing when I was first published. I knew no one in the publishing industry. For some reason, The Air Affair was a book that was, at its time, I think, relatively original. Mashup now is done quite a lot, but in those days it wasn't. This was 2001, and it was a book which was about Jane Eyre being kidnapped out of Jane Eyre, and because Jane Eyre, the novel, is told in the first person narrative, everybody's copies around the whole world is blank from page 200 onwards. So Thursday next, who works for Literary Detectives, has to find out who managed to get into the book of Jane Eyre and kidnap her. Now, it also was a book that featured alternative history. There were vampires. There was time travel. So it was there was Shakespeare in it. So there was this strange mix between the literary and the science fiction and the fantasy. And at the time, no one was really doing that, and they're still not doing it a huge amount. But I think it's slowly creeping up.
Right.
And it created a bit of a buzz, and it was published in the UK. And then 7 months later, it was published here in the US. And because it was a bit of a buzz, everyone went out and bought it. And I managed to get onto the New York Times bestseller list with my debut novel, which is, you know, amazing, in fact, especially when you look, see that it's like a mashup novel.
You must feel like saying, "Ha, I was right. All those 72 rejections. Take that."
Well, there is that a bit, of course. So it was very well received. And then I've just been developing the series, and I've got some other series coming out as well. So it's been very good, actually, I must say.
Now, you mean you're actually going to have more series than you already have?
I already have. So I have the Thursday next series, and this is number 7 in that.
Right.
Then I have something called the Nursery Crime
right.
series, which are police procedurals using nursery rhyme characters. So the first in that one was called The Big Over Easy.
Right.
And it was a police procedural with Humpty Dumpty as the victim.
Right, that's great.
So when the book opens, he's shattered beneath his favourite wall, and the detective inspector, D.I. Jack Spratt, and his assistant, Sergeant Mary Mary, who worked for the nursery crime division at the Reading Police Force in...
What a great idea. What a
fun. It's quite fun, isn't it? And they have to investigate it. And it's kind of in... You know, they find out more and more about him as the book progresses.
And you're taking familiar characters that are familiar with, the names that they're familiar with. And
yeah, absolutely.
Making them real people.
A lot of it is kind of moving the familiar furniture in people's heads. It's an interesting concept, and I must say I use it quite a lot with the Thursday Next series as well. This is stuff you already know, and it's because I'm moving it around and placing things on, you know, I'm putting things on different bits. You know, I'm taking a chair and I'm putting it on top of the wardrobe, and I'm moving all this stuff. You know, the Humpty Dumpty, which is very fixed in your head, I'm going, no, hang on, you've got to learn more about this character. So that was quite that worked actually quite well, really, and still does. And I followed that up with a sequel, which was called The Fourth Bear, and this was a retelling of Goldilocks as a missing persons case, because here we have an enigmatic blonde who goes missing. You know, if that's not a thriller, I don't know what is, to be honest.
Exactly.
And it kind of centres around, you know, the three bears and why were Mummy Bear and Daddy Bear sleeping in separate beds, you know, which I always wondered about. And of course, why was the porridge at different temperatures when it was poured at the same time?
And now with that, the success of Once Upon a Time on ABC, nursery, I mean, these kind of characters are becoming more popular too.
Well, yeah, I mean, I published these in 2000.
You got to jump on everybody.
Oh yeah, but they were written in 1993, so it was way ahead of the game. Well, the trends, you know, trends come and go, and who's to say whether it was me or not, I don't know.
You for a minute I thought you meant you were going to have more series than the ones you already had. I knew you had the other series, but I thought you sounded like you were coming up with yet another series.
Yeah, well, I'm going to, I always, you know, one always sort of tries to move forward as an author, and the fun thing about writing Thursday books is I know the world and the characters so well, I can come back to it very easily. And I think what we're going to do is take a break from Thursday for a couple of years, and I'll be writing some other books, maybe a sequel to a series called Shades of Grey, not the 50 Shades of Grey, that's another
right.
one, someone
exactly.
else's. The Shades of Grey series, which...
You had that title first, though, so you...
Well, I think someone else had it before me. I think it was actually an album, I think.
Was it? Oh, yes, yeah. You're right. I think you're right.
Yeah,
yes.
I don't think I was the first to use it at all. And if you look on Amazon, there are, in fact, I think about five books that have Shades of Grey in the title. So it's not unique by any stretch. So I got to write a sequel to that, and also I've got other ideas for, you know, new and unusual books that I
so
want to write.
You didn't answer about the way, how are your books accepted in Wales? What do people think of you in Wales?
Good. Yeah, I mean, I'm as popular in the UK as I am in the US. Within the books, there's this. I have this idea of that Wales is a socialist republic. It's a sort of, you know, breakaway, you know, country on the side of the United Kingdom, and that goes down very well in Wales, actually.
Well, yeah, and we have to talk about your young adult book that just was published. It's called The Last.
The Last Dragon Slayer.
Last Dragon Slayer, right? And this is a book about magicians.
Yeah, magicians and sorcery, and it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek look at wizards. You know, forget the old. There's a line that I think that somebody says in the book. You know, where they say, you know, it's not all pointy hats, broomsticks, and wands. That's just in the movies. So it's a kind of very sort of tongue-in-cheek look at magic and sorcery, and it's in a world where sorcery is fading, you know, the power of magic is fading, and whereas magicians once were, you know, mighty people who were sought by emperors and kings, now they unblock drains and rewire houses, you know, they do very mundane jobs. And it's all about the power of magic that is weakening, and how one person can make a difference in trying to bring back the power of magic.
Right. Your wife's very lucky. She gets a guy, she married the guy who's had a great sense of humor. I mean, I just love your sense of humor. And I mean, people like you are so much fun to be around.
Well, you're very kind, of course. But of course, at home, I'm just simply Dad.
You're just simply Dad. You don't have your sense of humor. Yeah. But you must have. You still have a sense of humor.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, but of course, people get really used to it, and then my children say things like, you know, I say something that I think's really funny, and they say, "Yeah, right, Dad." You know.
Like, you're not as big as you think you
are. Yeah, exactly. You know what kids are like. You know, and they go, even if I said the funniest joke in the world, they'd still be, "Yeah, right, Dad."
Now, so is your readership growing with each book?
Yeah, it is. I mean, slowly, obviously. You know, we're not reaching everyone on the planet yet, which is, of course, our goal. But it rises slowly. But there are fantasy books. It's like, you know, it's like sci-fi and fantasy are the two kind of genres that people kind of shy away from. And what I'm finding is that I meet people at readings and they say, "Oh, Jasper, I must tell you a story. And I go, "Okay." And they say, I'd heard about your books like four or five times before, and people were saying, you know, "This is really you. You know, you must read these books." And I didn't, because I didn't think it would be me, because I'm not a fantasy reader. And then they say, "But then I read it, and it is totally me." So there is a certain resistance to fantasy books and absurdist books. And I think there's some people seem to want to read either crime or kind of human drama, and that's what really, really sells. So there is a sort of marked resistance, but we're slowly breaking it down.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, we look at Harry Potter, who's all fantasy, but they're very serious books at the same time, though.
Yeah, it's like when people refer to, so you know, that the 50 Shades of Grey and Harry Potter and all those sort of things. It's like normal rules don't apply. You know, it's the Harry Potter series was such an extraordinary phenomenon that it can't be really compared to any other book, to be honest.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true.
But you're right, it was fantasy.
And yet I can't understand. I have people that I know that will say to me, "I never got into Harry Potter," and I can't imagine why they didn't.
Mm, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, you know, 3,000 years ago, when we, you know, people were telling stories about weird, you know, beasts that had who had a head with serpents coming out of it, and you'd turn to stone if you looked them in the eyes. You know, that's the kind of stuff that people were writing. It was all fantasy 3,000 years ago. And nowadays, we've sort of gone away from that. You know, I blame Charles Dickens, personally.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, and Austin and all those Bronte, you know, girls.
And this looks like you on the back of the book. Now, I should mention to everybody, this book is from Viking, and it's available in all your bookstores, just in case people are wondering. But this guy on the back almost looks like you, the one touching the book.
It does a bit, actually, doesn't it? Yeah, I don't think it is. But I love these covers. These covers are brilliant. And when Viking sent me some proofs of it, and they said, "What do you think of this, Jeff?" And I went, "Oh, it's just perfect. It's just brilliant." What they've done is they've taken is this an artist who's taken, his name is Thomas Allen, and what he does is he gets copies of old pulp books, and then he very carefully cuts out the figures which are on these lurid covers, and then sort of just moves them around and then takes a photograph of them. And I think they're just the most fabulously designed.
Yeah, like the figures we used to see on those pulp crime novels?
Yeah.
Sort of like?
Yeah.
How interesting.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's actually some illustrations in the book, and I didn't realize when I was reading it last night. All of a sudden, these illustrations came out. Oh, how great is this? They should have more of these. These
Absolutely.
Are fun.
Absolutely. Why do not more people have illustrations in books? It gives work to illustrators. It's a little bit of just extra. I don't know. I think it's just fun to visualize these things ever so slightly, just to give some hints as to what's going on. And I think it just warms a book, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And right at the back, something again I've been doing throughout the series, is in the old days, you know, you used to buy a paperback and you'd sell it you'd throw it away 3 or 4 days later. And there used to be adverts in the back of the book for things like, you know, hair oil and umbrellas and stuff like that. So I actually make up all these COD advertisements, and I put them in the back of the book.
And my brother fell for this ad one time. Was you could get all these army guys really cheap. I think it was like $3. You could get this whole bag of army guys.
Mm,
and he got them. They were nothing but these plastic flat things.
Yeah.
And he was so disappointed. I remember to this day how disappointed he was when he got them. They were just a piece of, they were junk. They weren't even three dimensional.
Yeah.
That's the kind of things they used to sell back then in these books.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You never knew what you were getting.
No, and they're always quite amusing. The gag, it was always big sell, wasn't it?
So is writing the most fun you have in your life?
Yeah, I think it is actually. Because it's imagination. It's just letting your imagination run riot, really. And but then making it all work, because of course you could think up silly ideas, you know, and that's all great fun and everything. But it's putting silly ideas and clever ideas into a context of a story and the characters and what happens to them that I find most.
I hope you don't get you in trouble with your wife for saying that.
Well, yeah, it's great fun. I mean, working in the creative industries is. For anyone who does it.
I don't think anybody could do it like you do, and that's the thing. If something should happen to you, who else could do what you do?
Oh, I'm sure there are lots of people out there ready to step into my shoes.
But how would they know where your thoughts were going? Where you were going with your...
I have no idea.
I mean, you must have a very complicated brain to do...
I can put ideas together and make completely new ideas. I think that's where it comes from. If I just say, right, you know, there's two people in the room, they're heading towards, you know, this town, what's happened? And then I look back in the books and think, oh, well, this happened. So, and then just start writing it. I don't have any plan when I'm writing at all. I just literally start with two people on a train. And I have a vague idea what might happen. And a few what I call narrative deaths.
So you don't even know as you're writing the book what's going to happen in the book.
No idea at all. And I think that works actually quite well for this sort of book. Is that when you start reading a Thursday Next book, or in fact when you start reading any of my books, you are constantly saying to yourself, I don't know where he's going with this. I do not know where this is going to end up. And I think it's because I didn't either. And I think that gives a book a real sort of an edge. As to you really don't know how it's going to end up.
Now, the plot lines, you say there's 18 different ones in this book or something like that?
I think we've got about five major plot lines.
Five
major.
But do you resolve them all in this book, or do they sometimes get resolved in another book?
I think the dark reading matter is not yet resolved. I think we move to another level with the dark reading matter. But all of the major plot lines are all resolved.
That's great. That's great. And you've got all that. Kirk says you're a breath of fresh air. What a great thing to say. And Kirk is
nice.
We all know how tough Kirk is going to be.
Yeah.
Do you care about reviews? I mean, do you get upset if you read a bad review of your book?
I'm quite lucky in that I do seem to have relatively positive reviews from.
Well, maybe it's because you have major talent.
I'm not sure really. But I think with all these things, you know, I mean, I never read the Amazon reviews. That really is, you just have to avoid that. Because somebody will say something and because they want to be funny and nasty. And you just avoid that. The best thing is not read reviews at all. Just stay away from them. Because you can read 100 reviews and if they're all positive, terrific. But you get one bad review and that's the one you think about for the next 3 months. So stay away from them. Stay away from them. Have confidence in one's own ability is the best thing to do if you're a writer. And because I wrote on my own for 11 years, you know, and finally got published, I kind of think, well, I think I know what I'm doing.
Now you're going to be in the area here, right near me, actually, about half an hour from me, in Haverford, Pennsylvania, very soon.
Yes.
I may have to come over and see you.
Yeah, I think you should come over to the talk.
Right, I didn't realize at first you were going to be there, and I thought, wow, that's really close, all the way from Wales, all the way to Pennsylvania, right near me. It's like, wow.
Yeah, well, you know, we like to sort of travel around a bit, and talk to people, and give talks and signings and things like that. So, I'm a touring in the whole of the States for the next month.
And we all know how hugely popular the foreign authors are today. I mean, with all the Norwegians and the Swedes writing all the crime novels, which are just all over the place.
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? I mean, I, the way I tend to look at it is that the crime genre now is so tired. It's such a hugely tired and overused genre that it takes subtle changes to, you know, really just putting it in the Scandinavian countries that seem to breathe, you know, fresh new air into it.
As long as they're translated and they don't seem like they've been translated. I don't like reading a book where I can see how it was translated. It's like a forced translation, is what I call it, where you can actually. But your books aren't translated.
No, they changed slightly for sort of the what they call house style. But they're pretty much the same as the ones that are in the UK.
So who has more of a sense of humor, people in Wales or people in the United States, in your opinion?
Do you know, it's pretty much the same. I don't see any particular difference between the UK and the US when it comes to talking to people about the books. The only major difference between the two nations is that in the UK, a room will fill from the back forward, whereas in the US, it'll fill from the forward back. Does that make sense?
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, so it, because the British were so reserved, you know, we'll come in and we'll sit right at the back, you know, because we don't want to sit at the front in case we get asked questions or something like that.
But in the
US, people are very much more forward, and they'll sit right at the front.
That's interesting. That's
the major difference. But the questions after the talks, I get a lot more enthusiasm because people in the US are much, much happier to put up their hands and ask questions. You know, in the UK, sometimes I have to coax questions. But, you know, once we get going, the Brits can be, you know, quite effusive as well.
Are we going to see any more of the Nursery Crime series, or is it just going to be the two?
I think there is a third one somewhere there. I must say I've got a sort of rough idea, sort of fleshed out. But there is so much of that now out that I should really wait until it's all died down a bit.
So you have an idea already?
Oh yeah. There's lots of things we can do. I think it was the title was going to be The Last Great Tortoise Race, and it's about the annual tortoise v hare race through the streets of Reading. And of course, you know, the tortoise has won, you know, 32 years running, and every time, you know, everyone bets on the hare. So there's a sort of it's kind of, you know, a bit of kind of a mix between sort of flat racing and the Sting and Formula One, and it should be quite fun.
I'm amazed you'll talk about it already, because, you know, somebody could steal that idea just listening to this interview.
there's more than just stealing an idea. You've got to flesh it out into 100,000 words, and that's hard work.
It is hard work, and I don't, and the more I read, the more I realize how hard writing must really be.
It's time-consuming, is what it is, and it's concentrating. You have to concentrate on one thing for 6 months, to almost the exclusion of everything else. And that's really what it takes.
So those 6 months, you don't read anything else? You don't?
No, I don't really do much else, to be honest. I'm working from, you know, 10, 12 hours a day.
You're kind of cloistered like a nun.
Yeah. in my little cell.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess that's what it has to be, because you really have to concentrate. Now, if you tried to read another book, wouldn't it mess you up?
Well, not really, because then what happens is I'm reading a good book at the same time, and then I think, I'll find some idea in it that I think could be subtly, you know, woven into the plot. So as I'm writing, things happen. You know, I read them on the news, and I listen to things on the TV, and, you know, bits just sort of seep across into the book. So it's actually, some of it is actually quite helpful. It's all part of the process.
But you don't seem to have any trouble keeping your books interesting. Your books are always interesting. So, I mean, is that difficult to keep them interesting every moment? I mean, when you think of 300 and some pages, like in the new one, 300 and some pages, is it difficult to keep it interesting all the way through?
Well, I mean, that's the clarion call, I think, for any author is don't be boring. Some people enjoy reading books that have lots of description in them, you know, and people just enjoy the prose in books. You know, there is that sort of side of, you know, high literary work that people really enjoy. I'm kind of not in that, you know, I'm more in the entertainment industry part of the book world. So I just don't be boring. It's the most important thing, you know, be interesting. Make people guess as to what happens next. And as soon as I'm writing, you know, when I'm writing and I've got half a page of description, then I know that that's, you know, a quarter page too long, and I'll have to cut some of it out, break it up with dialogue, have something else happen. It's very important not to be boring, but it's very easy to see when you are being boring, and you think this just goes on for too long, out it comes.
Right. Amazing. I'm amazed that you guys do it so well. I mean, this book took a little bit longer than some of the other ones to write. I mean, do you take, what, generally a couple of years to write one of these Thursday Next books?
No, this is 6 months. I mean, this
really?
Was, yeah, this was...
To be published from... When did the last one come out?
Hang on.
So it only has been a year, okay.
It's been a bit longer than a year. I think it's been about 15 months.
15 months, yeah.
For the first six books, I brought out a book a year at the same time of the year. And if I work hard, I can bring out a book a year. But just recently, last year I had two books come out because I've got The Dragon Slayer and The Thursday Next. So that's why this one has gone slightly further because I had another Dragon Slayer book to bring out. So I've done 12 books in 12 years. It's a book a year.
Yeah, I see you've already got the second and third one planned in the Dragon Slayer series.
Mm, yeah.
You know what you're doing here.
Yeah, churning it out.
Now, how long is this series going to be, the Thursday Next series? I mean, you're already working on book 8, I take it.
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, the thing about it is it's a very broad canvas. There's an awful lot of stuff I can write about. So I don't think I can see any particular end to it. It was just if people get bored
with
it.
And Penguin seems to be asking for your books.
No, they're still very happy with my work, which is wonderful, and they're a great publisher. I'll just keep on writing. I won't do Thursday all the time. I'll just do another couple of books, and then I'll come back to Thursday, and, you know, we'll just keep it sort of ticking over like that.
Is Thursday your most popular character, do you think?
It is at the moment, but probably because I've got seven books in the series, so it would kind of, and I've had them out for longer.
It must be great to wake up in the morning and know you've accomplished something so major like this. I mean, to be published this many books, to be so well-known, to have people wanting to read the next one, people must write you and say, when's your next book coming out?
They do, yes. It is very nice. I must say, it is very, very gratifying, and to know that people are reading it and, and enjoying it. So it is hugely enjoyable, I must say, hugely enjoyable.
And it's got to be great to know that even when you're not around anymore, people are still going to be reading your books. I can't imagine that feeling.
Yeah, well, hopefully they will. Yeah, I mean,
do you find yourself getting attached to series books? Do you like a lot of series books?
Series books are a kind of double-edged sword, really. All the characters are kind of already there, and a lot of the situations are there. So there's a kind of shorthand that exists when a reader picks up a book and they've already read, you know, six in the series already, and they kind of know what they're going to get, and they can just go whooshed straight into the story. But the downside of series books is that you're not creating something new every time. And I like creating strange, unusual worlds, which I find very amusing and great fun.
But I'm wondering, you yourself, do you read other people's series books? I mean, do you have favorite authors? Do you have...
Not really. I tend to just read anything that interests me, to be honest.
What usually interests you?
Well, I read a lot of non-fiction. I quite like science books. But it's really whatever I just happen, someone says, oh, you must read this, and then I do, and I think it's brilliant. But also, you know, I watch, TV and movies and the theatre. So it's all story, and I can use it, all of it, to my advantage. You know,
right.
So it's not just, if you're an author, you don't just get everything from other books.
Do you think there'll be a series? Do you think there'll be a series of Thursday Next on TV?
On TV? I don't know. I mean...
Would you like there to be?
I'd like if it were good, but It's a problematical to make into a TV series because there's so much going on that either you say, right, we're going to chuck out 70% of the novel and make it into a movie, which I think would be wrong,
right.
Or you say, right, we're going to spend a lot of money and we're going to make each book into, you know, 3 1-hour for telly, and we've got, you know, a 28-hour miniseries of the entire book, the series. So, but, you know, that's not going to happen yet.
Yeah, you're right, it would be problematic with all the characters.
I mean, that's a huge budget, and, you know, will people want to watch it? Don't know. But we haven't really been approached. We haven't had a serious approach for the Thursday Next series.
Wow, cool. Cool or not cool, I'm not sure. I mean, it'll always be alive in people's minds, reading the books.
Yeah, I mean, half of it is it's about books and stories, and perhaps it's not meant to be... you know, filmed entertainment. But if it were done well, I think it could work.
Right. Well, you look at Game of Thrones and how it's done on TV, and you watch the show, and you're like, boy, these are what those books are all about. Just as, it doesn't seem like it's the full book anyway, and I see where your concern would be for that.
Yeah.
So what is your day-to-day like? I mean, do you spend a lot of time writing? I mean, do you spend 8-10 hours a day writing?
Yeah, when I'm in a full writing mode, I will spend, you know, I could spend 10 or even 12 hours writing. And generally what happens is that I find it easier to work with text that I've already written. So I will write, you know, the first day I'll try and write a couple of thousand words, and then the following day I'll be editing those or partially editing them, and then writing another new couple of thousand words, and a day after that then I go back and I re-edit what I've written and then add more words until after about 3 months I have roughly 80,000 words, and then I go back to the beginning and I start going through it again and changing and moving and chopping and shifting, and I do that several times until I feel it's ready. So I have two distinct sort of writing modes, if you like. There's what I call the scribblage, which is just getting the words down, and then there's the combing, which is just literally just combing through the prose and making sure that it all sort of...
I wonder if you have time to have hobbies, if you have time to
do... Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got far too many hobbies. I mean, I've lots of children. I don't know whether that counts as a hobby, but I got tons of kids. I got 6 children.
Do you really? Wow.
Yeah, lots and lots of children. And I'm a very keen aviator, so I have an aeroplane. And I love photography, I always have, ever since I was about the age of 8, when I built a darkroom in the cupboard under the stairs, and I'm still very, very into taking photographs.
You have a very full life.
Yeah, I have a vintage car as well, which I love to tinker and take on rallies. So I'm very busy.
Very, very cool. Well, I think we've gone past our allotted time with you. We have to say goodbye, unfortunately. But I've so enjoyed talking to you.
It's been a pleasure.
The book, number 7 in the Thursday Next series, is called The Woman Who Died a Lot. I love that title, by the way. Mm-hmm. And it's just out from Viking. It's in all your bookstores now. Everybody goes out and buys it, and you're going to find it very fascinating. I'm laughing just thinking about it now.
Yeah. And there's lots more to be found on my website, of course, which we should try and mention.
Oh, absolutely.
JasperFord.com.
That's a crazy website.
It is a crazy website, yeah, and it's quite useful because if you're completely new to my series, then you can actually go on the website and you can see what sort of books they are and whether they're for you.
Well, I hope everybody does. Thank you so much, Jasper. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.